Hi, welcome to the show. This is WPEB's special show that's part of the Scrap Radio Project on the Community News Reporting Workshop that I've been on. My name is Long.
Hi, my name is Jody. I'm also a participant of the Community News Radio Workshop. And today, Loan and I are going to be sharing some interviews that were done by our fellow workshop participants.
Yeah, I'm really excited about sharing these stories. What did you think about some of these interviews?
I thought all of them were meaningful, and some of them touched on organizations or projects that I might have been familiar with before, or specific concepts that I've previously heard of. And I would say that listening to them, I have so much more of a deeper understanding about some of the themes that are going to be coming up in some of the interviews than I did previously. Harm reduction or even birth work, those are things that I'm familiar with. I've actually done doula training in the past before, and I'm not doing birth work on a professional level, but just hearing Paloma talk about her motivations and what inspired her to get into that work and what it entails when she is supporting parents or soon-to-be parents, it was really informative.
So the first story that you'll be hearing today is interviewed by me. I was struck by a question that I didn't yet know the answer to for myself. It was posed by Paloma, and it's, what is my birth story?
Could you give me an introduction about who you are?
My name is Paloma. I've been working as a doula for 2.5 years. Yeah, this work for me started from a place of like a very personal way because it's because my sister got pregnant, and it's what inspired me to take my first workshop, and the rest just sort of like developed on its own, really.
Where are you from in Philadelphia?
I am based in Southwest Philly, and I've been living here for about 5 or 6 years now. I grew up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is like 1.5 hours away from Philly.
So, what power do we gain by knowing our own birth stories?
I think that you learn a lot about relationships when you think about your birth story. I feel like for me, learning about my birth story is like connecting to my mom in a very different way and connecting to my parents in a different way, just knowing about the stresses that they were dealing with, about the difficulties and how in a lot of ways those moments that were like in my like tender beginnings, right? Those were moments where I was absorbing so much and learning so much about my relationships, about my parents. And so much of it is like, it's overlooked because we were newborns, right? So we think that we don't remember things. So we're not carrying anything still. But I find that especially in learning more about my mom's postpartum period, I find that there are a lot of things that I absorbed in that time, even if I don't have memories about them. So yeah, so I feel like it's learning about how my life started and how many of the things that I know about today, whether they're good things or negative things about myself, sometimes I can like track them back to that moment. And so much of it is about support too, because I think in like the struggles that I've had with my relationship with my mother, a lot of it can be traced back to that beginning time that she didn't have the support that she needed. And like, you know, as a birth worker, that's what I encounter a lot, like trying to make sure that the parents that I work with are supported and have that community so that they don't feel so alone and so they don't feel like the pressure of the world when it comes to having a newborn that you're responsible for. Yeah, so it's definitely as a birth worker informed the way that I support parents that I work with in a big way, but in my personal life, it's also informs and like gives me more context for the beginning of my life, I guess. Yeah, and the first lessons that I learned.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And you said you call yourself a birth worker. I know it's been called the doula and there's other terms. Can you just give us a little more detail about what is that role for the mother while giving birth?
As a doula, I support the birthing person from pregnancy through to their postpartum time. This support is different from any other medical provider that you see. It's not, you can't really equate it to a doctor. It's not medical advice. You can't relate it to a midwife. You can't relate it to a nurse even. a nurse can sometimes fill that role of support because they're the person who's with you the most if you're giving birth in a hospital, but they're with 10 other people or who knows how many people they're working with at the same time. And with a doula, this is a person that you're working with from as early on in your pregnancy as you want and who you're developing a relationship with, and you're teaching them and like you're learning together how to best make you feel supported, because we all have different ways of feeling support. It's about having one person who specializes in you and who specializes in your care, a familiar face in the context of a hospital where there can be so many different people coming in and out. But even in a home birth, it's somebody who has been with you from the beginning and who knows what things might come up for you. Or yeah, so that support, it's not medical, it's more emotional, it can be spiritual, it's definitely physical support, it can be a lot of hands-on support, whether it be like massage or like helping you get from one position to another to help labor progress.
You mentioned earlier that it started from a deep place of connection with your sister who was about to give birth. Was there some support that you weren't seeing that she needed? Is there support generally that's missing from mothers? And that's how this role of the doula serves that need?
I've practiced a lot as a home birth doula. And in that space, it's a very different context. People who seek out home births tend to have a lot of awareness about what the birth process is like and are really invested and motivated and interested in the physiological like progress of labor. And to a hospital, there's a bit of a different setting where there's, I think the way that providers treat the patients is also a way that is assuming that they don't know or assuming that they don't care or assuming that they can't make the decisions about their own body. And these are things that happen often, especially when we're talking about women of color, Black and brown women. It's something that can be life-threatening. And yeah, so it's something that is definitely a need in my opinion, it's a need when it comes to giving birth in a hospital, to have somebody who knows your preferences, who knows your goals in your birth, and who cares and who wants to help you like achieve them. Often in a hospital setting, there can be pressure, whether it be simply about time when a doctor is trying to see all these different people, they're rushed, they don't feel like they have the desire to walk you through the whole process so that a birthing person can make a decision that they feel good about it. At times it can feel really rushed and forceful. So a doula steps in as an advocate in that situation because, you know, being educated and knowing this person's specific desires, they're able to support them through those moments of if they're feeling forced into some procedure or some intervention. A doula can be a person to remind you of your birth plan, to remind you what are the things mm-hmm. that you've decided originally you wanted, and is this something that feels good? Part of that childbirth preparation is also learning how to advocate for yourself, because as much as I may want something for you, if you don't want it yourself, then there's no reason for me to fight for it, for me to push for it. If it's even as somebody who has worked with a birthing person throughout their pregnancy and talked about their preferences, it still doesn't give me the right or put me in the place to tell them what to do. And preferences change. It's not a plan that is set in stone. You might change your mind. Something might come up that requires that you change your mind or that you come to a different decision. In that situation, a doula can step in to help soothe that transition so that it doesn't feel like a jarring decision, that all of a sudden everything you wanted is lost. It can be a smooth transition into acceptance of a different path than what you intended. Support in the hospital is very different. It's much more about advocating. It's much more about watching and making sure that people are respecting all the bits and pieces of a person's birth preferences and not being sneaky. Or it's not uncommon in a hospital setting for providers to make small decisions or things that they feel are small decisions that can like impact greatly a birthing person's journey. So it's the type of thing that you got to like be watchful and like make sure that things are going the way they should. It's a very different setting and definitely one where I feel like it's even more essential to have that birth support.
Sounds like such a delicate balance, and there's a tension, right, with how medical experts might approach helping a birthing person make a decision, and then the way you're describing how to help them frame the decision-making process. How do you help them navigate different frameworks, whether it's coming from you or the medical provider? How do you make it easier to make the decision versus like more complex?
A lot of the work that happens prenatally is preparation for all of the possibilities. And that's the thing about childbirth. And we talk about that, about how like birth is like you're standing on the edge of a precipice, and like you get to decide whether you want to take all the things that you can with you, every single little bit of knowledge, or to just throw yourself in and let the experience happen. And both options are totally valid. And regardless, even if you take everything you can with you, there's still no way for you to be 100% prepared for it.
Speaking of all these scenarios, it sounds like you have to pull upon so many resources of your own too, for every unique scenario and every unique birthing person. What would you say is your superpower when you're right there with the birthing person? And how do you access that?
My presence at a birth, it's very quiet. A lot of people that know me see me as a pretty outgoing person. And like, but in a birth, I feel like I transition into this person that is like a fly in the wall. Like I'm another presence there that isn't trying to take over the situation. It's never a thing of like telling anyone how this is going. It's a place of like, of witnessing. It's a place of paying attention to whether it be like more energetic or like really about somebody's physicality, what I can learn and hear and see without needing a whole conversation, without needing to talk everything out. I think my superpower is being present without taking up a lot of space and being able to fit in exactly where I'm needed and figuring out what that is. It's not something that's easy because again, like birth is something that is so dynamic. There's so much going on the whole time and it can be hard to figure out where your place is, but it's what I have the most fun doing. I really enjoy being able to observe in that way and yeah, and to bear witness and to take the information that I can to make decisions and to make proposals or offerings of ways to smooth out the process.
So yeah, I mean, what you're speaking on is just, it's just so deep because we all came into physical existence through this like shared experience of being born out of feminine or the female. And so what are some ways we can honor this experience, like no matter our condition in life?
I really liked that you started this whole thing by sharing that question that I asked so long ago, that like for me it feels like it was, I think that question of, you know, do you know your birth story, and figuring out your birth story and honoring that transition that somebody went through for you, that whole experience of labor that somebody did for you. That's a really powerful way to honor that, to listen to it and to become a doula in your own right to your mother. Like I think a lot about how people who don't have access to their birth mother and about how you can still honor that without having direct access to that knowledge. And I think that by learning more about birth and by learning more about what happens in a hospital and educating yourself more about what that experience is like, it's a way to honor and to acknowledge something that, you know, women have been doing for centuries, and that regardless of our access to those stories or those people for ourselves, there are still ways that we can honor that journey and acknowledge how major it is and how hard it can be for so many people.
Really, for me, my earliest memory is what I think when I was maybe 3 years old, and I only have like a few memories of the ages between 3 and 5. And then obviously we develop more of a capacity to remember more as we get older. And when Paloma was talking about even what happens in the space, even before we have an active memory, and how when she learned more about her particular birth story and the experience of her parents in the postpartum phase, right? The first months of a child's life, and how she connects that to who she is now and her personality, her characteristics. Like that was just really so mind-blowing for me to think about, you know, what that means, that even if people don't have a memory of what happened when they were 6 months old or 9 months old, that it has an effect.
If you'd like to learn more about Paloma's doula work, you can follow her on Instagram at Paloma, PalomaLadoula. In a truck-to-truck interview, our workshop participant E interviews Billy, who describes what harm reduction is, its history, and some of the ways this term has been misused while speaking out about the vital work that the Soul Collective is doing here in Philadelphia. This interview dissects why harm reduction is vital in a society in which many people are offered limited options when it comes to their survival and well-being, while touching upon the importance of holding agency over our decisions.
Welcome to the Truck to Truck interviews. I'm sitting in a Ford Ranger and Billy is sitting in
a Mazda B3000.
I'm here today to talk with Billy about harm reduction. Billy, could you start off maybe by telling us about the kind of work that you do in the community before we get into that?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for talking with me about this. So I am a community organizer with an organization in Philly called Soul Collective. That's Soul, like S-O-L, like the sun in Spanish, but also it's an acronym that stands for Save Our Lives. We are a harm reduction organization, meaning we support people who use drugs, who do sex work, and who are living unhoused, housing unstable, sleeping rough in Philadelphia in a variety of different ways. But the kind of central ways are supporting people with sterile, safe supplies for drug use, and that's drug use across the various like forms of it. So not just what we might classically think of as like with like sterile syringes and supplies for injection, but also supplies for smoking and for snorting, to kind of expand beyond the like injection centric way of thinking about harm reduction. So we support people with supplies that they have expressly stated that they need, that will both support health and work to also prevent overdose. We provide folks with naloxone or Narcan, wound care supplies, and wound care from trained nurses and EMTs, and do overdose reversal trainings in the community, and do a lot of public education around the history and ongoing impact of the racist and specifically anti-Black war on drugs and the current overdose epidemic in Philly, but also obviously across the country.
So I wanted to talk to you because Soul Collective is a harm reduction organization. And I wanted to talk to you because I think that I have heard so many people kind of just throwing around the phrase harm reduction. And I'm not sure if we as a community of people truly understand what that means. Would you be able to speak about that a little bit more?
My understanding of this has definitely been shaped by, like, I would say just like a ton of ancestors and elders and current people in the movement who themselves are drug users, are sex workers, are unhoused people like living at the margins, who have really like shaped my understanding of this. So I just want to make sure that that's like clear, that I take like 0% credit for this analysis. Harm reduction comes out of like a bunch of different places, right? It's the idea that it's common that people say, oh, harm reduction is meeting people where they're at, but that doesn't like go very far. I don't think that says enough. Harm reduction is the idea that people deserve to be safe, not just safe, but also like protected, making the choices for their body and for their lives that they choose to make, regardless of like the legality of those choices, regardless of the potential danger of those choices, and regardless of the like social acceptability of those choices, because we know that we live in a world where people, like, choice is a really complex thing. A lot of the time we talk about drug use as a choice, sex work as a choice, etc. People like, sure, make choices to do those things, but like, it's, and I don't want to conflate sex work and drug use too much here, of course, but like, people make choices sometimes out of a selection of very, 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 very limited ones. And so harm reduction is the idea that like, within any of those circumstances and choices, people have the right to be as safe as possible. So that can extend in so many different directions. People talk about how like, there's like, there's basic classic harm reduction we do every day. Like, I'm wearing a seatbelt, like, in my truck right now. That's harm reduction, right? Because I could possibly get in a car accident. And if I do, I won't get as hurt or die, which is, like, some as a principle that can also be applied to, like, if I give someone their own unused crack pipe that has, like, a mouthpiece attachment, they can use it and then take the mouthpiece attachment off before they share it with somebody. And so maybe they won't be at risk of transmitting HIV or Hep C or whatever.
Or even COVID.
Or even COVID, which is a whole other thing, right? Like, yeah, exactly. It's become even more important during COVID while, like, resources have gone down, overdoses have gone up, access to healthcare has gone down, et cetera. So yeah, I think that harm reduction has its origins in, like, places you might think of, like, STAR in New York, like, black and brown, like, trans women who are sex workers, who are, like, completely housing precarious and living on the margins, taking care of each other, providing housing, providing a safe place to stay, providing people with condoms or rides or whatever. Like, all of that, all of those things help people reduce potential harm so that they stay as safe as possible doing what they have to do. And also, like, an example that folks talk about, like, Monique Tula from the National Harm Reduction Coalition talks about, is, like, the Black Panthers, the free breakfast program is right. An example of a harm reduction initiative, right? Because, like, the harm of a child not having access to food, right, can be reduced by creating access to food. And so I think that people, like, it's troubling the way that harm reduction gets talked about now, because A, it's completely disconnected from those origins. And there's obviously the origins of the coming, like, stemming out of HIV and AIDS. It's, like, our sort of, like, more contemporary understanding of it with syringe exchange programs and things like that. And that's really important. But I think those origins specifically with, like, Black and brown, trans and queer sex workers and drug users and stuff like that is, like, really key. And people want to use harm reduction a lot of the time, I notice now, to just sort of talk about doing a behavior because you want to.
like not as a survival technique, but
yes. Yeah. Like voting, for example. Like, people talking about voting as harm reduction, and, like, I'm saying this, I'm a white person, right? So, like, I don't even think any white person should ever say that, because we're not the people who are, like, the most impacted by the harm of whatever elected officials do. But, you know, there's a whole counter argument there that's, like, who is the harm being reduced for? You know, and how can you be sure, and why, you know, why use this language? It definitely gets used by people to sort of, like, make an excuse for doing something that they want to do that they don't want to have to be accountable for necessarily. I think that the idea is, okay, well, like with the voting thing, it's like, okay, yeah, sure. Some harms reduced for sure without Trump, you know, or whatever. But, like, what other harms are not reduced? What other harms are amplified? We can't talk about it like that when we're picking and choosing the harms, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really popular moment for harm reduction, which in, like, some ways is cool, because in a lot, sometimes, like, normalization of ideas is, like, good and useful, but also there's, like, a lot of co-optation from, like, public health and social work, or with specifically, like, when it comes to, like, supporting drug users, supporting sex workers, street-based sex workers, specifically outside workers. There's a lot of clout to be had in, like, talking about harm reduction and working in harm reduction, but real harm reduction, and I would argue, which is, like, another reason why I'm trying to give credit to, like, everyone I've ever learned from, harm reduction is, it matters that it's directed and led from within the, like, communities of people who are in need of the harms reduced. It's not a charity ditch. It can't come from the top down. Harm reduction cannot come from the top down. It's, like, it's definitely, like, a mutual aid thing.
What can people do to support the Soul Collective? Or people who are already, like, invested in harm reduction?
Well, we are, like, a grassroots collective. We're not a 501c3 or anything, so we're not a nonprofit. So our budget is super shoestring. So if you are a person who believes this work is important and has disposable income or disposable generational wealth, you can donate to us. We're, like, on Venmo and Cash App at Soul Collective 215. We also have a PayPal, Philly Soul Collective. That's an option. If you're a person who wants to get more involved with the on the groundwork, let's say you yourself come from a cross-section of like experiences with drug use, with homelessness, or sex work, and you are interested in getting involved with street outreach. Also like street outreach if you are a person who has medical skills, if you're a doctor, a nurse, or etc. And you want to get involved with street outreach. We do trainings for that. You can email us at outreach@phillysoulcollective.org. to initiate that combo. And we always are taking donations of all kinds of things, but like warm socks, bottled water, snacks, gloves, pepper spray, plastic bag. There's like a whole host of things we need. That's another way you can support. Also, you can help us spread the word about our free naloxone mailing program. We've partnered with an organization called Next Distro that we work with in order to mail doses of Narcan, so the life-saving medication that reverses an opioid overdose. You can help us spread the word about how folks can get that mailed to any residence in Philadelphia completely free of charge. The mailing is like discreet and anonymous, and you can sign up to get a dose sent to you, or two doses sent to you, at Next, N-E-X-T, distro, D-I-S-T-R-O, .org/Philly. So tell people about that, especially people who might not have insurance or who are like less mobile, and specifically for people who live with or are themselves a person who is at risk of an overdose. Good. Which, because of the presence of fentanyl in drugs right now, extends beyond just people who use opioids and extends to people who might more casually use stimulants or something else too. We also can mail fentanyl testing strips to people who need them, in addition to Narcan. What else can you do to support Soul Collective? Just like boost our work, have us come train your workplace, your organization, whatever the case may be, in how to reverse overdoses, how to use Narcan, and how to like better understand the context of the racist drug war and overdose crisis in Philly. Option two, all those things, you can hit us up on our Instagram, our Facebook, or our email at outreach@phillysoulcollective.org.
Cool. Thanks so much, dude. Once again, that's Soul, like the sun, S-O-L, collective. I really appreciate you.
I appreciate you too. Thanks for talking to me.
Just going back to Billy, like the message that I got is just, that was very powerful, is just a reframe. Like harm reduction isn't trying to change behaviors, like meaning, oh, I'm a drug addict, I want to change you to not become a drug addict anymore, because it's like a black and white decision. Mm-hmm. It's more like, okay, you have limited choices. How can I help you make the best quality choice among the limited options you have? And mm-hmm. here's these resources that I have. And I think it just speaks to the lack of equity among choices that everyone has. And not every choice is absolute. And this means the same for everybody and their circumstances. And I think we can judge them, you know, we can judge someone making a decision that we wouldn't make, like what you mentioned, shaming. So I just really appreciated that challenge to think differently, even if we wouldn't make that same choice, and mm-hmm. how we could be just helpful to the situation versus just alienating people who kind of make the quote unquote wrong choice.
You know, I have a level of personal understanding and familiarity with harm reduction practices and harm reduction as a term. And hearing Billy talk about, for me, people who are marginalized to the point that mainstream society really does ignore them. And, you know, thinking about practices being normalized, for example, Billy was talking about distributing Narcan or talking about overdose reversal training. And those are things where even if someone does not know anyone who, you know, in this case is a substance user, really, when people talk about having Narcan be readily available, it's for as many people as possible, you know, so that you could be walking down the street. And even if someone is a complete and total stranger to you, if you have a level of awareness or even training, or if you have specifically Narcan on you, that you can, you know, you can literally ultimately end up being able to save someone's lives. And, you know, I think, you know, people think, you know, from what I'm understanding, when Billy was breaking down harm reduction, a lot of people might operate in a way that's shame-based and to say, well, if you use drugs, then you are solely responsible for the negative effects that that substance has on you. Or if you are a sex worker, then you are responsible for the adverse effects, whether that be police violence or whatever the case may be. And Billy, in that interview, was really reminding me, and I hope other people as well, that really, you know, to have us shift our thinking, right? And in the case of distributing training and supplies that can have an effect on people who do use substances being able to receive care. Even, you know, when she was when Billy was talking about trained nurses implementing wound care. And so things like that. It you know, for me, it just really deepened my level of understanding of what it means to pay attention to issues or even people that are erased day to day.
To learn more about harm reduction and what the Soul Collective is doing, you can follow them on Instagram at the_soul, S-O-L, _stories. Jody interviews Jerry Hilt, an Afro-Indigenous artist who talks about how nurturing an intimate relationship with one's environment has the possibility to reverse the harms caused by extractive industries.
Hello, I'm here with Jerry Hilt, who is a creative director and art producer engaged in environmental restoration and advocacy, cultivation, and radical sustainability and Afro-Indigenous political initiatives. Hello, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you so much. How are you?
I'm super grateful for you setting aside the time to answer some of my questions.
Thank you, I'm grateful for you.
What does environmental intimacy entail?
Environmental intimacy is a term that I really developed to refer specifically to relationship and practice. And my hope was that by using term intimacy, people would begin to explore what their relationship to the natural world looked like. And I also wanted them to feel a certain amount of ownership over both the term and their relationship to the environmental world. This is an initiative that seeks to shift consciousness and reconnect specifically Black and Indigenous women to practices that are both innate and ancient and familiar, that for many of us have only largely shifted within very recent generations in reference to connection with the land.
How does the state of the environment relate to the health of communities on the Gulf Coast?
Well, specifically in Louisiana, there is an above average, arguably an inordinate number of oil refineries. It's one of our major industries, both the extraction of oil and the complicated chemical heavy process to clean it from crude oil into the petroleum that we use to power our cars and more. And there's a lot of environmental waste and environmental and toxic products that are a result of that process. That toxicity is often released into the air and carried by the wind.
Mm.
And so while there's not an overwhelming amount of research that correlates this toxic waste from oil refinery to direct health influences,
mm-hmm.
what we know is that there are radically increased pockets of cancer, both mm-hmm. in adults and in children,
mm-hmm.
not far up the river and up the wind trail paths
mm-hmm.
of some of these oil refineries in the state. So that's a much more corporate, large-scale impact of health as it correlates to the environment. However, just the aggressive, indiscriminate extraction of oil already negatively impacts the coast and ecological balances. We've experienced this in very globally historic oil spills on the coast that not only traumatized the environment, but poisoned the food source coming out of the ocean. Of course, we know that everything, all the waterways in our region are connected. They're largely tributaries that feed from larger sources to smaller sources. And so anything happening in one space has the ability to carry over into other spaces through the connectivity and the water network.
When you envision the coastline coming back to itself, what does that look like to you?
I'm so glad you asked me that. Earlier this week, I went to the river, which is my practice, and some of that time is about prayer and wellness and being centered and being connected and feeding my relationship to the natural world myself. But it's not a one-way process. And so this week when I was at the river, I saw a very specific level of rebirthing post-winter, early spring. I saw this expressed specifically with the trees that along the banks of the Red River. The river itself is red largely because of the sediment that it carries, and more specifically because of the iron and some of the minerals and the oxidation in the sediment carried by the river. The river was more red than I had ever seen it, and there was just something really special going on in terms of regeneration and revitalization just from the transition from winter to spring. So when I envision the coastline coming back, I envision natural environment that, like human bodies, are put in ideal circumstances to heal itself and regenerate. And so I think what that really means for us is that we have to find ways to not inhibit the healing and regeneration of the earth and environment and these natural systems. And I think that if we can get out of the way as part of our dominant practice, meaning if we can just stop cutting down trees, trees do come back year after year. The ones that are meant to, the ones that can sustain themselves, if that answers your question.
And what are the implications then for yourself and other people in your community? Earlier you spoke to the at least correlation between the after effects of, or even, you know, how toxins and chemicals make their way into communities and end up affecting the people who live on the Gulf Coast. So this process that you're speaking of in terms of the natural environment healing itself, what are the implications for the people who are living in this region?
Well, specifically, I believe that a connection to the environment is already healing in its own capacity. That makes sense. We're already living within environment where we're depending automatically on our oxygen needs and air quality being met. This is a natural process that we often take for granted unless and or until it's inhibited. We're already dependent on our ability to both have access to and to sufficiently clean and distribute water. And so I guess in this particular praxis, in this particular model, the hope is that by being consciously connected, we are more aware of all of the changes happening in our environment. Just by our increased awareness, we are better positioned to respond, to intervene, to receive information, to delineate information, and to create positive change in all the ways that are necessary, simply because we're not tuned out, simply because it's not something blindly happening around us until there's a crisis.
What is a recurring ritual you recommend to more deeply connect with one's environment?
I would like to offer a daily example and then maybe a slightly higher energy requirement example, I was going to say the river, going to the river, of course, because of all the ways that it is both grounding and revitalizing, and it does put me in touch with natural, free ecology in a public space in a way that makes me feel a part of a longer, more dominant conversation in terms of the natural world. That said, before I had a regular practice of going to the river, my family, for as many generations as our oral history connects, have always been coffee drinkers. Mm. You know, kind of before it exploded in popularity in a very particular way in the country, when, you know, just quiet, very rural, small farm folks were ritualistically drinking coffee with their families for all of the natural benefits of what the bean provides. And we do produce coffee here locally. Something as small, something as accessible as a cup of coffee with intention, I believe is powerful enough to connect you not only with the land, but to connect you with all things. I know it's a bit of a buzzword, but there's a level of mindfulness or conscious engagement and awareness that can be engaged in all practice. You know, drinking a cup of water, drinking a cup of tea, drinking a cup of coffee, all of these come from our natural world. And if we appreciate and acknowledge them as we participate, mm-hmm. those things, I believe, in ways are enough. My practice of going to the river extends beyond that, and so too have the gifts. But before I was going to the river regularly, I was consciously drinking coffee, feeling connected to an entire region, feeling grounded, feeling connected to the land itself, and tying my own consciousness and awareness into the production of a natural bean, you know, mm. that grows and is sustained regionally in my environment.
What do the brown pelicans remind you?
Oh my gosh, now you're wanting to get so personal. I know that we've been able to, I've been so privileged to share professional and private space with you. And I know that you've heard me speak of this. I'm going to be direct and say that recently, inside of the last 3 years, I have really come to experience the presence of brown pelicans as a direct connection to my ancestors. I have been able to communicate with them without words, just around history and travels and mutual vulnerabilities and mutual accessibility. And when I speak about environmental intimacy, our bodies being feeding off of literally the same materials as the brown pelicans and therefore being made of similar things is kind of what I'm speaking of. So just a quick reference to what I was discussing earlier. The brown pelican in Louisiana became an endangered species later in the 70s after mm. the use of a particular pesticide mm. that poisoned their water and food sources and was causing them to die at an alarming rate. I do not believe, because this pesticide was affiliated with crops, I think that an explosion in cancers that we saw both as a region as a country mm. within the next 10 to 15 years could not have been unrelated. Mm. And so we're literally sharing the environment, and we're made quite literally of the same things. And so when I engage with the brown pelican, fully rooted in my indigenous and African blended identity, I experience them as a direct reflection of my own ancestry.
I really love listening to your interview, especially the question about how Jerry felt about the brown pelicans. It really just took me to another place, like just visually, and mm. I could just feel the weight of this imagery of this animal and its connection to protecting and conserving the environment. And I really appreciated that. And I think, yeah, all these interviews really challenged us to look into the stories of other people and the work that they're doing to for the benefit of their community. And I think that's kind of the through line between all these interviews is like, how are we caring for one another and sparking our imagination to think about other forms of community care?
I would say as well, in addition to the importance of thinking about care and thinking about how we can show up more for people in our communities, I think something that was also coming up for me when I was re-listening to the interviews was the importance of attention mm-hmm. and the distinction between what and who we do or don't pay attention to and the implications of that. You know, even Jerry talking about her ritual of drinking coffee or even her regular daily walks on the river and how one particular day it was so striking, the changes, the flowers, the depth and the particular shade of red and little things like that, that for her are a part of a bigger story of the, you know, her community and her region and this the lands that she's indigenous to and what, you know, what is happening in the environment and how that's affecting even the actual health of people who live along the Mississippi River or who live on the Gulf Coast. And so I think in addition to attention, I would say care as well. Or in addition to care, I would say attention and paying closer attention.
Yeah, I love that you're calling out the attention or like the quality of attention paid to some of these issues. Despite what we're experiencing and have been experiencing for a year, with mental fatigue, physical exhaustion, insecurity, instability, whether it relates to our own lives. But I think all of these interviews challenge us to look outward and care for others.
To connect with Jerry Hill, you can find her on Instagram at @achafalaya_fox.
Marcelo interviews Ben Miller, the co-founder of South Philly Barbacoa, who talks about the People's Kitchen, a space for the community to cook and organize. The People's Kitchen also prepares and distributes free meals. In this interview, Ben discusses how the initiative got its start during the pandemic and how it can provide an alternative to the traditional hierarchy within the culinary industry.
Can you start just by introducing yourself and the role that you have at South Philly Barbacoa?
My name is Benjamin Miller, and I am, I guess, a co-founder of South Philly Barbacoa, along with my wife, Christina, who's the head chef. And the People's Kitchen, my role over there is to try to make sure that the kitchen's running smoothly. And I'm also in meetings with folks who are doing the political organizing strategy along with the 215 Alliance.
Could you talk a little bit about how the People's Kitchen initiative came about?
When restaurants shut down last year, around March 16th, my wife and I decided that we had to do something. And so we started doing free vegetarian meals, you know, that were offered during the day. Yeah. And in that same week, I got a phone call from a chef named Aziza Young, who's a private chef. And she is working for an NBA player for the Sixers and that had given her some money to help the community out. So she had enough money and budget for basically doing 2 weeks worth of meals for some low-income and elderly folks in North Philly. So she called me, got my number from a mutual friend, and asked if she could use our kitchen to prepare the meals. And she was looking for a place to cook. And I said, sure. So she showed up and had a different chef with her every day. And in that time, like, I really liked her vision, and I reached out to Jose Andres, who is the founder of the World Central Kitchen, and I asked him to jump on a conference call with a bunch of Philly chefs and give us some guidance, you know, from his wisdom of, you know, cooking through crisis, you know, around the world. And he did that, got a bunch of Philly restaurants connected with World Central Kitchen, including ourselves. And also, and so that helped out with like the funding part and keeping it going. And then I reached out to the 215 Alliance, which I'm also on the steering committee over there. Mm. And we partnered as a way to be most impactful with the meals and also try to do political organizing with the meals. Mm. I also reached out to CMAC right away, and they were one of our partners from the jump as well. So pretty soon after we had got funding from World Central Kitchen, we moved the project across the street from Barbacoa to El Compadre, which is our former space, which had been shuttered for a little while. And we were using a little bit as a commissary and space, but really no activity going on over there. And this is during a time when we're trying to figure out how we're going to continue to pay the rent. And, and this project kind of moved into the El Compadre space, and we started calling it the People's Kitchen. And so we kept up with Aziza's model of having different chefs every day. We reached out to high school students who started coming in, working with us as paid interns. And, also within that first couple months, we started a garden, a farm on 70 plots at a community garden in Point Breeze that were growing all the vegetables for the restaurant.
And what kind of political organizing took place in this space?
Well, one of the things we did were there was some stimulus money that went out specifically for undocumented families. And so through like our organizer, who's kind of like the liaison with the community, the one who's calling the families who are going to be receiving the meals that day and kind of helping the different meals to go to different places, because we're working right now with like about 9 different organizations. So we might prepare 300 meals in a day, but there might be going 9 different places in the city picked up by different volunteer drivers and stuff like that. So that person was able to connect with families and get them these like $800 stimulus that was available for undocumented families. So that's one thing. We're also pretty involved in the elections. We helped get probably about 30 different chefs activated with funding so that they could go to different polling places and give out food. We're constantly just trying to listen to the people and find out what the needs are. But 215 itself is a political organizing group, So, I mean, Kendra Brooks, who is now a council member, was on the steering committee of 215. I mean, 215 was also involved in work around public schools, around Helen Gim's first election, around Krasner's election. So they've been involved in the Philly political scene. So this is kind of a partnership between a free restaurant and a political organizing group.
Right. And then when you, first started this initiative, did you have any predictions for like how long this was going to last, or was it more of a day-by-day thing?
At first we planned on just going until the funding ran out. But then we really realized that this is a good way to have, this is a good model for a restaurant, and why can't it be permanent, and then how can we start to think beyond this like temporary crisis funding and get ourselves situated with more sustainable funding that we can continue to provide free meals and help organize the basin, along with 215. What we just started to do is a sustainer campaign. So kind of like the Bernie Sanders model of like a bunch of small donors, but we're asking people to be like recurring donors. So like if you can give us $10 a month, if you could give us $25 a month, and we could get 1,000 people to give us $25 a month, like it's going to pay all of our overhead, all of our organizers, all of our chefs, and our food costs. And that way it really will be the people's kitchen, from the people, like no institutional money, no grant money, totally funded by small donations of people. So that's what we're shooting for now. I mean, obviously we're still writing grants because we want to have a safety net and a plan B and stuff like that. But we launched our sustainer campaign last week, and we're already over 100 sustainers.
Do you really feel like this could be a permanent model for the kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, the current model as it exists is is kind of autocratic, right? It's like, it's almost fascist. Like you have an owner, chef owner or something like that, and they're boss, and the workers have to, you know, please the boss, and the boss kind of decides how he's going to pay people and how people are going to move around and what he's going to do based on his or her own, you know, benevolence.
Yeah.
Or maybe not, you know? So this is like totally a different spirit. It's a cooperative from the very beginning that's putting the workers first and putting the community first. So I think like we're waking up to the fact that, you know, this is a good use of the kitchen, you know? It shouldn't be like this elitist exclusive space, you know? Yeah. And what we're trying to do also with the mentoring of the young people is try to not get them to all go towards fine dining, you know, and to show them that, you know, to show them some of the issues in the community around food justice and social issues that they can apply their talents. So I think this model is needed. I don't think we've 100% figured it out yet, but this is kind of like the creative process. And I feel like we will figure it out, because if we can crack the code of how to do it and how to figure it out with the funding, then we'll be able to open up a second people's kitchen or open it up or show someone else in another city, you know, how you can do it and how you can partner with local organizers that are already doing campaigns in their local community, and kind of the food helps the organizers, you know, and the organizers help to create a good restaurant space, you know.
Has the kitchen always been like a space for activism and organizing for you?
When we started, I really don't feel like there was much of a precedent that I knew about, you know, apart from like the activism around sustainable agriculture from somebody like Judy Wicks or Alice Waters or something. But when it comes to talking about labor or undocumented workers, you know, or racism or sexism, these conversations weren't happening. And I was inspired by the artists and musicians that I was checking out. When we first decided to share my wife's story of crossing the border illegally, this was around a time when Ferguson was happening, with Mike Brown being murdered. And, you know, the musicians I was checking out were speaking up on this kind of thing. You know, you didn't hear anything from restaurants, you know, but I heard from the musicians, right? And then, you know, somebody like Nicholas Payton was, you know, I'm checking out his music, but I'm also, you know, so I'm already kind of like into what he's saying. So I'm going to be like open to hearing what he has to say about something, especially something that he's speaking from his own personal experience about, you know, or somebody like, you know, Paul Robeson or Muhammad Ali that were using their platform to fight for the community. And so we thought that, you know, this is an issue that, you know, talking about undocumented workers, that their restaurant owners can't avoid forever, you know, and it's not going to get better for us if we don't step into the arena and start to talk about it. And then we have this huge platform as restaurateurs and food people, that there's TV channels devoted to us and magazines and food blogs. And, you know, we're really at the center of culture in a lot of ways. So how can we co-opt that space for social change? Over the last few years, I've seen, you know, a lot of good progression of restaurants wearing their politics on their sleeve a little bit more, you know, which I think in a city like Philadelphia you can do, because, you know, it supports people who are authentic and are telling the truth, and, you know, are not afraid to, you know, upset a couple people. Like, you know, like, why should we, you know, just keep our head down and stay quiet and cook good food so that rich people can come that don't want us to be here in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
Like, our customers were Mexican families, and, you know, and so we're cooking for them. We didn't know if we were going to alienate people, or if, you know, we were going to get into trouble with this kind of thing, but I found that the opposite of that happened. We started getting new customers, college professors, activists, people in the community, people that heard the story and say, hey, like, we have a similar story, you know, we're supporting you. And we still get those kind of people. You know, we've been on, you know, some national, international media at this point, and people are still hearing about the story and connecting with us and coming and to the restaurant and thanking us for, you know, speaking about different things. And so, it's been a positive thing. I think it's created also a somewhat of a safety net, because I feel like, for example, ICE, they like to operate, you know, in the darkness of night and trick people, you know. So like, we're always surrounding ourselves with a bunch of lawyers and activists, and so, you know, I think, you know, we're not as much of a target as somebody who's just easier to, you know, we know how to handle ourselves on media and stuff like that. So I think we're a little bit more of a threat.
I think all of these, interviews just really challenge us, as you said, to pay attention and care for others.
I agree. And I would say, on the theme of attention, again, or even like you're saying, in the context of the pandemic, you know, we might be so isolated or so caught up on our own personal experiences and the effects of the pandemic on us as individuals that, you know, it's still important to remember others who might even have less resources or access or power in society than we do. And so, yeah, that was something that was coming up in all of the interviews.
To get connected to resources around food insecurity or free meals or volunteering, you can visit the website 215pa.com/peoples-kitchen. Thank you for listening to WPEB production in collaboration with Scrap Radio Project. My name is Long Wing.
And I'm Jody Nicole. Please be sure to check back and be on the lookout for more programming. We are all new producers for WPEB, so please stay tuned and check back in for more upcoming programming from the interviewers.